This episode of A Glass for Every Palette is brought to you by Blinders. Blinders is the great way to enhance your wine tasting skills. Whether you're a newbie, it is super educational, or you're an enthusiast that just wants to be challenged, Blinders is the game for every wine lover at every level. Get your deck at shop.somtv.com. Hi guys, welcome to this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palette. Here we are in season two and just back to back with great guests that are really notable and up and coming and some less notable than others. This one is really notable though. You know, on this podcast, we try to talk to people that are not only in the space of wine, but food, wine, and culture. And I think that our guest today very, very much embodies all three of them. Welcome, Aldo Song. Hi, Aldo.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
Welcome. I'm good. I love how cheery you always sound. This is the energy that I need. How are you doing? It's very cold in New York today. Did you go cycling today?
Honestly, no, I did not because it's so gusty, the gusty winds.
It's freezing.
But, you know, it's ironic that you asked me this question because, you know, sometimes life puts very strange situations on you. And you have to have a choice that, you know, you're trying to make the best out of it. So as we had to close the restaurant mid-December, I had for once, you know, and I haven't had this in a long time, a holiday season like normal people do.
Right? You weren't working on Christmas Eve.
No. And funny enough, for the first time I understood why people do dry January. It didn't make any sense to me before. Finally, I got it. But then, you know, as I'm a very passionate cyclist, you know, and I think when you're this long in this industry, because I'm a dinosaur in this industry, is you have to make sure, you know, you maintain your passion and you have to take care of yourself in order to sustain the normal thing. That being said, so I sit on my trainer because it's one of these ugly snowy days and I sit next, you know, I have a man cave, literally. So I have my cyclings, I have my smart trainer there and I sit next to the wines. And I thought, I became hungry. I said, I need a glass of wine. I'm really craving one. And then, of course, I got off my thing, off my dry January very quickly after day four. like most people do. And so that being said, and I thought, you know what? If I don't do a dry January, at least I put myself a goal up for cycling 1,000 kilometers this month.
Okay. This month,
I think that's something close to 600 miles,
jeez,
something like that. And
are you going to make it? You've got a couple more days left in the month.
It's actually 621 miles. As a matter of fact, I'm already over it. I know I'm overreaching. But again, this is a little bit like I saw that number and I started targeting. What I didn't estimate, I have to admit, when I made this decision, I was a little lightheaded. Because I underestimated the cold. And you can't do long rides because I get typically very quickly cold in my fingers.
Okay.
And it becomes miserable. But so I'm over it, so it's good.
That's good. You've reached your goal. And that's, I mean, I get it. Like you can do, I actually like cold weather, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to, like, even dining out. I've been trying my best to continue to support all of our friends in restaurants, but it is really cold at night.
Yeah. And I go lately at night a lot because the roads are much quieter.
Yeah.
And especially in the park too. But, you know, I mean, I'm from Austria. I don't mind cold, you know, don't get me wrong. But once your fingers become really painful, is that, you know, this needling thing, then it's unpleasant.
Yeah. And I think that that's what happens with dining. Like you can keep your body warm, but in order to eat, you kind of need to have your hands free. And it's been getting interesting. Wow. Well, see, we jump right in because these are how our conversations go.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you've done so much. I'm not going to call you a dinosaur. I'm going to call you a seasoned veteran.
Thank you so much.
That's what we'll go with. But I think that few people know how this actually started for you. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, the culture of food and wine and just how it's enjoyed in Europe is so different from what we traditionally do here in the States. How did you start? Like, what's the first bottle or glass or experience that you remember making you more interested and making you want to learn more about wine?
I mean, look, it's obviously, I think this, it's a tricky question because obviously you start melting two different cultures together, which is typically very challenging. And, you know, both have their rights in place. What we do in Europe and what's very common, you know, working in a restaurant scene, meaning as a front of the house or back of the house, that was a career or that is a career and people had to study that for that. I know in the United States, when I came over, everyone asked me if I'm a writer or an actor. And it was really, really, really hysterical to see. I said, no, 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 this is my job. Right? And they were all confused about it. So, again, but the system is very different. I, of course, understand that. So I went to a tourism high school, tourism college in that sense. And, you know, after I graduated, I started working in the restaurant industry. But back then, I didn't like wine. Because I thought that's sour, astringent, and really didn't do anything to me. I had much more approach, and we can drink in Europe with 16, not with 21. That's a big difference. So I had more contact to Bacardi Coke. I know this is unimaginable today. But
would you still have a Bacardi and Coke for nostalgia's sake?
You know what? I thought about this recently because someone asked me this as well. And I kind of shrug a little bit. And I haven't had one in ages. But again, it's unimaginable today. But look, you have to be honest about it. That's how we got onto this. And I mean, and then, you know, like everyone does, you know, you continue with some very generic brands, and like a Yellowtail. And from there, you move on because they're smooth, they're round, they're elegant. I know sometimes, you know, we became also fussy and then, this is not cool. But look. How does a normal person get into wine with having nobody on their hand, right? And, you know, guiding them in. These are typically things you do. And I'm actually thankful to anyone who comes. And that's how actually we met.
Oh, man, we can get into that story. Okay, so we both got wine because, and you guys should get comfortable. This is a really good story. I am drinking. This is Paul Hobbs' new project in Spain. He started making Agudelo, which is a Spanish white grape that I don't think a lot of people really dive into. I think it's quite good. It's got beautiful acidity to it. But unlike Albarino, there's a little more texture and weight to this. And particularly for winter, I like my white wines, especially if I'm not eating food, I like them to have a little more body. So this is good. I'm going to see how this evolves as we talk through this. It is not, actually.
But you were looking for a salty wine, no?
I was looking for a little bit of salt in it.
I know your palate.
I do. You do. I mean, that salinity, it's such an eye-opening thing. But I think that happens in food a lot too, right? Like where you now people are used to seeing like a salt or a savory component in a dessert. But it's such a flavor enhancer. So we'll continue to talk about this. What are you drinking?
You know, I'm a little bit biased. I'm actually drinking Grüner Veltliner.
Of course you are.
Listen, this is the one thing I've taken in the last couple of weeks. I've tried to drink wines which were, you know, between $15 and $25 a bottle, retail.
Good.
And I start really looking into this because, and I find it very enjoyable to research that. And I mean, obviously, at Le Bernardin, this is not a price range where I'm typically, you know, look for and I'm known for. But life is all about balance. You know, you can't go from one extreme. You have to look also on the other side. And I think that's always was very important to me. And actually, I drink my wine, the Lion, the 2019, because I just got a shipment in.
How is it? How is this vintage for you?
It's so exciting. I'm so happy about it. And you know, it's when you have your own wine, you're always nervous about this and nervous about that. And it's such a humbling experience to make it, you know, and have your name on the label. And that brings a ton of pressure with it. And, you know, there's growing pains. And that comes also with making wine. And it's a little bit like children. I don't have children, but those are my children.
Those are your babies. I totally get it.
And sometimes the wine, you know, when you fill it, the wine really doesn't show, and you know, it is really good. And then all of a sudden it blooms up, and it just makes you so happy.
Oh, great. I can't wait to get, I've got to get my hands on a bottle of it. So we will, I mean, that's an interesting place to start because yes, most people do start drinking at a much lower price point than what you'll see on the average restaurant list. Not even just Le Bernardin, just in general because of the markup. But I think it's important for people that are going to be engaging with the general public about wine to understand what it is that they do drink and then use that information to recommend bottles for them that based on that flavor profile, they might enjoy that they haven't been introduced to yet. All right, guys. So we promised you this story. I'm becoming known for these random stories in wine. This is going to be a good one. So across from Le Bernardin, if you're not from New York, Le Bernardin is on a city street in the 50s. It's in Midtown. And there's like a promenade between it. And on the other side of that promenade is Alvesome Wine Bar. When we commuted to work every day, it was really close to my office. So I went there all the time. And it is a tremendously inviting space. It's literally like sitting in a friend's living room. There's bright and vibrant artwork. The energy is great. It's one of the best playlist in New York City. I mean, literally everything from Levert and A Tribe Called Quest to EDM stuff to like top 40s. It's just great. And I would go in there and sit in the same spot all the time and just take in the scene because it was vibrant. And then after a while, I started noticing, why am I the only Black person in here? This is an inviting space. The price point is great. What's going on? And Aldo came in one day and we began to chat the more I came in. And I actually asked him that one night. I wish I could have filmed your immediate reaction to being asked that question. But in true to yourself, you gave the most honest and true answer. Like, well, I should ask you that, right? Because I don't know why there isn't. The space is certainly open and welcome. But that answer caused me to think about it like, well, yeah. I mean, I think that in a place like Midtown where you can get happy hour drinks, you know, you get 10 glasses of wine for $10 in the right seedy spot. I think that for some, not for all, but for some, you know, going someplace where the buy the glass is probably going to run you anywhere from 15 to 20 bucks a glass, but you should really just buy a bottle. It's worth it. And that just spawned a conversation between us.
I have to add one thing because you left this crucial detail out. Because I know you asked me this, and of course, you know, I'm a white person with a little bit of age to it. And of course, someone, you know, in a full blasting restaurant, I think this was somewhere in December.
It was.
You asked me this question out of this came from nowhere, right? And I thought about one thing because this, yes, I responded that way, but I said also, listen, I don't know because if you can help me with that, but I'd be thrilled because I go to everyone. It doesn't really matter what race or what culture or what confession they belong to, because this is why we love New York. You have this, you have this, you know, intercultural thing, and we learn so much as a result about it.
So, we do, and we've had such great conversation. Also, I'm good for just sprouting out my general observations about things, and there was no. It was literally just something I observed. Like, damn it, this isn't. It wasn't that I felt, you know, like it was an all eyes on me situation or out of place. It was nothing like that. It was literally just an observation I made, and I think that the universe heard it too because I don't think there's been another time since that conversation that I've came into the bar and been the only Black person.
No,
I don't think that's ever happened again.
I think after your next visit, there was one table and I pointed it out, which
right
I've never done.
That.
I've never pointed out people. I said, do you see?
Right. Well, because you know what? What's weird about that is that it's not something that anyone that isn't a minority in any space, you wouldn't realize it, right? Like in rooms where there are very few women, if you ask most men how many women in the room, and they say, I don't know. It's really that they didn't stand there counting it,
nor should they, right? But if you're a woman and you're one of few women in a room, you certainly can easily identify that you're only one of a few women in the room. So I think it's just something that happens innately. But from that, I feel so grateful that we've been able to have so many authentic and sometimes challenging conversations just about, and this is long before, you know, the events of 2020 happened, just about the world and how we experience it.
I remember that vividly. And look, obviously, as you can hear from my accent, I grew up in a different culture. I grew up also from a different time, you know. As I'm from Austria, you know, I have a very different education in that sense. And obviously, I'm very sensitive to different topics because, you know, in one culture, you can say things, in another culture, you cannot say these things.
Correct.
Right? So that's often a little bit where I have a slight disadvantage because my heart is very well intended. Right?
Yes.
That we have these kind of conversations actually saddens me because I thought we lived in the 21st century all along. But I admit I am naive on that part. And that's why I so enjoyed often this hard-on conversation with you and with another friend, remember, when we really bucked heads. But I think what the key part was and what it did on me, it was, it's important you never lose the dialogue.
Yeah.
And question also yourself as a result.
And that's what makes, I feel like that's what forms like authentic relationships and drives inclusion, because you don't have to know everything, right? But if you have relationships with people that you respect and you value, then you can at least be open to listening. Like, you know what? That is a perspective that I never considered. Like, it never even dawned on me to
Correct.
Think that way. But now that you've brought this to my attention, I'm going to take this and I'm going to sit with this and I'm going to do some reflection and see, like, have I done this? And even if I haven't, what can I do to make sure I'm not inadvertently creating these types of environments? That's how we learn. We also have to give each other space to make mistakes, you know? Very interesting. I was on a chat on Clubhouse, and there was a woman, she's a white woman from the South, very, very lovely. And she was talking about an experience that she had at a restaurant. And she used a word that I know for many people in Asian culture is derogatory, but a lot of times in American culture, because it's used to describe so many inanimate objects, it's not seen as offensive. So because there was a very, very mixed group in the room, I just took a moment to say, listen, I would put my name out and say she was not intending to offend anybody, but I recognize that that word to some people in Asian culture might be offensive. So I want to just take a moment to apologize if you were offended by it and allow this person to correct themselves, which she instantly did and said, you know, I'm so sorry. I am older and from the South, and I recognize that there are some words that I just shouldn't use, but I don't know them. So thank you for pointing it out to me. And we went right back on with the conversation. You know, there was no need to vilify her or harp on it, but we acknowledge things, we accept the feedback, and then we can move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, this is interesting. You know, I think as long as you take an interest in another person's opinion and feelings, and again, listen, sometimes we are by our own actions so unaware that sometimes it's important that a friend pulls you on the side. You might want to reconsider this.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never thought about anything bad about it. You know, that's the irony, but it might not come out that way. This happens to me all the time because, again, English is not my first language.
Right.
And the last thing I want to do is, you know, offend anyone. And also, again, listen, also in terms of the whole racial topic, to me, I look for talent. And again, I use, to me, I really don't care whether from which culture they are. They have to be good.
Right.
That's bottom line, you know, they have to be talented.
It's, you know, something that I admire about you that I think because you are such a pleasant person, just in general, I don't think a lot of people get to see, like, the amount of diligence even at your level, that you still put into tasting new wines, tasting new producers, and always being open to sharing that with anyone, no matter what level they're at. That's such an example to all of us of how to approach introducing people to wine. I mean, it seems like you enjoy the people that don't know that much, that you can take them on this journey.
Yeah, but this, I mean, listen, teaching is actually one of the highest forms of learning yourself. I mean, look, you study, but you can only study in one way. The moment you start teaching, you know, your students ask you questions you never thought of.
Mm.
And they can be these so-called stupid questions. I highly disagree they even exist. But
same.
You know, they come from such a different angle which you haven't thought of. And, you know, this is why, you know, I wrote the book Wine Simple. That was the idea to it, because I did not want to, you know, create a book from a sommelier to another sommelier. I mean, of course, listen, we sommeliers are very friendly and I love the community and I love to be in this industry, obviously. But I see this in the wine bar on a daily basis. You have people are scared to just order a simple glass of Sauvignon Blanc. And I'm on the other side. Listen, I'm dressed in black, sometimes with a tasse de vin. That can be intimidating, I've been told. But to me, listen, it's wine. I mean, it's not rocket science. Huh? We should have fun. And what's worst case scenario? You don't like the wine? I can bring you a different glass.
Yeah.
If this is what it takes, I don't save lives, huh?
You do save lives. You just don't know it. You know a night at the wine bar is free therapy.
But you know what I mean. But
I
you know what
mean
I mean.
Yeah.
It's wine, you know. I mean, this should be fun. And this brings people together. And that's actually the greatness about it, why I love this so much. And look, for me, it's not difficult. I love my job.
The
I love
book
being
is
around
great.
People.
My parents have started diving into the book because they've now been bitten by the wine bug and want to learn more too. One of the most interesting stories that you've ever shared with me is like people even at your level sometimes still kind of act like you don't know what you're talking about. And I think about, you know, in the same space, people like Sarah, who we just adore, and Marie and all the other women that are part of the team about, you know, there's certainly an added layer for them, but there's a part of me that almost feels like I would expect someone to challenge, you know, a woman or a person of color in that way. I was actually really surprised to know that people do it to you. The first time someone did that to you, was there ever even if you didn't express it, was there ever a moment of kind of like self-praise or arrogance in your mind? Like, do you know who you're talking to? Like, buddy, what are you doing here?
No, first of all, look, I love my team. I adore my team. And I actually, I provoke them also to push me back. And we have this punchy dynamic. It's fun. No, but we mutually respect each other and it's just fun. No, this happens. I mean, listen, we had this. This is now a couple of years back. There was one sommelier who took care of a single diner and he was very wine interested. And he opened a couple half bottles. And then at one point, his name was David, went up to the wine cellar to grab a different wine. And he looked at the wine list. And then I went to him and said, can I help you? And so, yeah, I said, I looked for another wine. So I pointed him two different wines out. And then David comes back and he said, David, he recommended this or this wine. What do you think I should take? Right? And David became all of oil. And I said, listen, I had to laugh. For me, this made my day. So I said, David, why don't you take over? Listen, he said, yeah, absolutely. And then I come back after a minute or so and the client said, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I said to him, listen, let me be quite frank with you. You made my day, and more importantly so, you made David's day.
Yes.
I cannot thank you enough. And what is life with not getting a good laugh out of it? And you made me really laugh because I enjoy it, because typically it's always the other way around. And you made my day and David's.
Oh my goodness.
Thank you so much.
That's
great.
Good that you can take it that way. You know, it always, it feels I am a believer, like there's a lot of things wrong with society and we see and we know that. But I am a strong believer that there are moments where we can acknowledge what actually happened, the facts of what happened versus the interpretation that our lived experiences make us feel happened. And that's always an interesting point to go on. And I the guests that you have at Liberta Den are sometimes the same people. You know, I've had great conversations with a bunch of people that stopped in the wine bar to have a glass or two before their reservation at Liberta Den. But the clients can be quite different. And this takes us very interestingly into natural wines, right? Oh, man, I'm high-fiving myself for that pivot.
I know.
But that is a great place to look at how, you know, like it can't be a total rejection of anything to do with preservation or intervention in wine, because then I have to be allowed to say, well, this just doesn't taste good to me.
I think my team is high-fiving you right now when they hear that.
It can't be that there has to be some benchmark for like, okay, I just can't get behind this, right? And you I've extended my mind and my approach to diving into natural wines because of how you've done it, because you've remained constantly open to understanding this. So tell us a little bit about how your perception and reception of natural wines has evolved.
I'll be perfectly honest. I'm a traditionally trained sommelier. That looks always for sound wines. You look for flaws, right? When you start making wine, winemakers look even more for flaws. So that being said, I came to a point, especially when I wrote the book Wine Simple, I started looking deep into this topic, obviously, because it's such a heated topic, even in the wine world. And it's almost a little bit like a tribal way of thinking. And by looking deeper into it, I started interviewing also people, and I went out with a lot of, I remember this was one research tour, I went with Christine Mulcahy, you know, who wrote the book with me. Or she made the book sound English because I don't speak English. Can't give her enough credit for that. That being said, we went out for a lunch with, I think it was 7 young foodies. And I brought Sarah Thomas with me, who brought a natural wine. And I know I brought Chardonnays. We went to a Thai restaurant, and so I brought Chardonnays. I brought champagne. I brought sparkling wine, and I brought dry and off-dry Rieslings. And ironically, and that was a key moment for me where I started learning, and it was an eye-opening experience for me, where they opened that natural wine, and to me, that thing was volatile, funky, right? And I just trashed the wine, right? As one would do with my mindset in that sense. And again, I'm being fully honest to myself there.
Right.
And then I've noticed all of a sudden, I've lost my conversation with these young people. And the only thing where I gained it back was and said, look, let me ask you a question. Because to me, again, in wine, in the world of wine, you realize very quickly, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know anything.
Yeah.
And I believe that. But that being said, I said, look, the best bottle of wine was always the one which is first finished. No matter how many points a wine has, it doesn't really matter. And I said, look about it. The sparkling wines, which no one really cared for, all bottles are empty. The Chardonnays, empty. The Rieslings, including the sweet ones, empty. The only wine where still a third left is that wine you were so excited about. Now, let me ask you one last question. Would you order another bottle right now if you could? Because it was so delicious. And they said, probably not. And again, it gave me it was very interesting to observe. So I started diving deep into that. And I interviewed Raj Parr for my book. And I asked him a couple of interesting questions. And he gave me really great answers. I talked to Bobby Stuckey. And then I thought, you know what? I should talk to Alice.
Yeah.
And because she's one of the most forefront people on that. And I talked to Pascaline, of course, too. But I talked to Alice. And I said, Alice, just so you know, because she said, why? You don't like natural wine? I said, well, look, I don't know anyone better. And I might want to check this with you. I'm not picking an argument with you. I just tell you this right now. I'm just reversing the role. I'm the journalist. And I'm asking you today, is that fair? And I have to admit, it was one of the best days I've had by writing this book. It was phenomenal.
Wow.
Phenomenal. And I've learned one thing. We've actually, and I wrote in the book, actually, we had so much more. Sadly, we had to edit and reduce the text. This follow-up was a long follow-up email on top of it because, you know, her mind, and I think my mind, was racing after this interview on top of it. And we've learned, actually, we both actually like the same. It's even, you know, it just has to be delicious. Now, what is delicious is highly personable.
That's subjective, yes.
That's highly personable, right? So, I mean, one loss, you know, creamy butter Chardonnay. The other one wants it really focused, very mineral, very tight. Who is right and who is wrong? That's personal. So, and this summer I made a step further since I had the liberty. Sorry, I always say this summer, meaning in summer 2020, I had the liberty to be in Austria. And I became very friendly with Christian Cheetah. And we've butted head quite some times.
To be a fly on the wall in that conversation.
No, but we had full-on conversations and it drove him nuts. But I've noticed also, you know, you had to challenge him also. Because of that, we went into the vineyards multiple times, in his vineyards. I went down to Verlich. I went down to Sepp Muster to see these vineyards. And I had the liberty to exchange over both, over their farming practices. And I was able to taste the grapes also just before harvest. I've learned so much about that topic. And look, the natural wine world is, when you look, it's also shifting a little bit. And I think in our wine world, I got a little bit tired about it. And I talked to Alice about it. I said, listen, Alice, this has to stop. This tribal thinking. This is wine. Wine should bring people together, not apart. This is not politics.
Yeah.
And look, you like what you like. That's all good. There's great conventional wines. There's great natural wines. And vice versa, it can be also the opposite. But we just don't have to get, you know, I don't want to talk to you anymore because you drink only natural wine.
Yeah, we can't.
That's not the case. That's too much.
It's going too far. And it's so funny that you bring that up in like language and the languages that we use to describe wines. You know, I had a very lengthy conversation with some average consumers about like when they see tasting notes and things like that, what it does to them, right? Yeah. And so many times it robs them of an experience because they read tasting notes that don't really sound like something you want to drink. Right. And, you know, if you understand wine better, then you can put those terms into context and you have, you know, a correlation with your palate of what these things mean. But if you're a novice and you're just reading and you see grapefruit, parsley, chive, chervil, rock, like that doesn't sound appetizing at all. And so I actually challenged them. I'm like, look, next week we'll come together, pick a wine that you drink in the next 7 days, and I want you to describe it exactly the way you want to. You know, if it's situational, if it's more you correlate it to people, you know, I've heard people correlate to cars, to experiences. And I think the more we open up the language, the more we start to understand and exchange and share bottles that we don't think another person would like, or they don't even think they'd like it because they have this perception, right? Like Sancerre is green and grassy and it doesn't taste good, right? I know a lot of people that think that. That's so not true. There are great wines from Sancerre. You know, so I think that the language that we use, language is important, and it does so much. Particularly, both of us are from different cultures. We're not American-born people. Opening up the language to be culturally relevant will naturally open up wine to more people. But if you keep using things that people don't know to describe it, it's going to be really hard, right? If natural wine just gets described as funky, and I find a lot of them to just not be good.
Look, it's, I cannot believe I'm saying this, what I'm saying now.
That's what happens on this show.
You need, look, and this is for somebody who works the floor specifically, very, very important. You need to look, you need to know your audience. You need to look who is in front of you and what kind of day they had. Did they have a good day? Did they have not a good day? And like that, you adjust the wine. So you have to be inclusive in that part. You know, you have to get people into your conversation, not put them away. Now, look, with natural wines, look, ever since I came back from Austria, I'm trying quite a bit. And I'm now, since I have time for the first time, I try these wines over a long period of time. Right? I open it, taste one glass, you know, put the cork back on and let it sit and taste it after a couple of days again. What does it do? Is the volatile acidity getting stronger? What does this come up? And it's funny, you know, and this can be with any type of wine. I just had this conversation. I did an interview because I did this wine tastings, you know, this wine simple tastings. And I've interviewed Piero Incisa from Bodega Chakra.
Oh, and, Piero.
Yeah, we all love him, but it's funny. I shared with him a story. I said, look, I showed that in that tasting, the Sina Sulfreda 2019. Mm-hmm. And ironically, the day prior, I opened his 1955, which, the 55, which is actually comes from the same vineyard. It's just the first, day one, the wine, I tasted it and it really didn't, it was tight, it was very shy. It smelled a little bit greenish, a little stemmy, mm-hmm. and it didn't do anything to me. And then the next day I said, wow, finally I get the wine. It really opened up.
Yeah.
But we live in such a high-paced world. So we don't really, you know, by the time the wine really blossoms up, it's already gone. It's done, or we're already on the next two bottles already.
That was on the list at the wine bar for a while. I feel like I consumed several glasses or bottles of that.
I got to enjoy this and I got to see this. How does the wine evolve and when does it fall apart and, you know, and how long does it hold its strength? The same on natural wine, because they say, listen, we can keep these wines on for such a long time because they move. And it's interesting to see what does and what doesn't. I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's wine, you know. Some of them you absolutely love and some of them you don't. And the world doesn't end because of that. It's with food the same thing, right? Just because you don't like oysters doesn't mean...
Oh, man. Don't not like oysters, though. They're good.
But you see what I mean?
Of course. And it's interesting that, you know, like, I think that's an interesting question for you. So if someone listening to this is just like you, like they have their perceptions about natural wines and they want to taste wine, even that term, I feel like it would be a lot more, it would be received a lot better if we started saying like minimal intervention versus natural, because natural makes like words like that, then the opposite of it is unnatural, right?
Well,
it's like this term of clean wines where like, so if it's not called a clean wine, does that mean that all other wines are dirty? No.
You see, again, the term itself is very, very misleading in a sense.
Yeah.
And also in today's world, because it became such a trend, many winemakers jumped on their bandwagon and, you know, there's a lot of really questionable wines there. But also, look, again, because of the Alice, because of the interview, because of questioning also myself, maybe I've overlooked something. I pulled myself on the nose and started visiting these winemakers. And again, when you visit people like a Christian Cheetah and he goes with you into the vineyards, as a result, you will approach these wines very differently. If you go, for instance, to one of the changing experiences was to go to Verlich, you know, to talk to Ewald Cheppe. And one of the funny side effects of that was, listen, the wines are wild. When you go into the vineyard, it looks like a jungle. I'm really, it does. I mean, you have no idea. It's really, but it looks wild. But talking to Eva Chepe, I fell in absolute love with that guy because you get a therapy session with it. That guy is so in tune with himself and is so works with Nietzsche and how he reads this and how he follows that. And I thought it was just so inspiring that I started approaching his wines in a very different way. And it's just, it made me shift. And I thought, you know, why do we have to take the sides there? Look, there's for every occasion, there's a wine. And sometimes in a mood for that type of wine. And again, I think it has to be inclusive. And I'm really tired about this tribal thinking. And this is like in food and wine pairing. Sometimes you have a wine which you absolutely dislike, but it transforms with food completely and vice versa.
Absolutely.
So, and I think that's the mission we have to have as sommeliers or as wine professionals. And I found this very, very interesting. Again, only a fool doesn't change his mind. And I totally admit that. But again, I put the homework in to research it.
You do. And I heart you so much of this. But I'm curious, you know, because you've been on this journey now to have wines at a very unique price point where the truth is that's where the average consumer, maybe not New York. And it took me talking to a lot more people. I think New York, it's true what they say sometimes about our little bubble, right? And that most of us, we don't buy our wine in the supermarket or in Target or anything like that. But a lot of the rest of the country does. And I've had to kind of recalibrate how I explore new wines for that reason. So what have you found? Any bottles that you really, really enjoyed at that price point? There are a lot of good bottles at that price point too. But what has there been any that really surprised you?
I mean, look, to this point, because it's often... wine is often measured by price point, and it's often driven the sales by that too, right? You're part of a clique or you're not. And look, we should not forget one really crucial thing. Wine is an agricultural product. It's a food. And people historically have been paid by that. If you look to the Roman soldiers, they've been paid in wine. Why? Because they couldn't drink the water back then. It was not purified enough. So they drank the wine. Obviously, they altered this a little bit. They sweetened it and they added spices to it. But they've been paid in that. So, and look, how many wine regions are in trend right now? Some of them are not. And as a result, they're way too cheap for what they should cost and so on and so on. I mean, listen, this conversation could be endless. Me personally, I don't add so much weight into that. What is more joyful for you when you go on a discovery and take yourself the burden away to have to purchase after the price? You just purchase what you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
And your spirit becomes much freer. And I think that's also part of the natural wine part where they came in. Look, they come in a very different free spirit in them, which is actually very rejuvenating. I find that very, very interesting. And look, one thing I've always learned, and this is on my research trips, is also people have a tendency when... myself included, I go in a store, and if I don't know the wine, I always buy wines randomly because I always research and look. But what if I don't like the wine? That's the greedy. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. They buy the bottle with the fear, what if I don't like it? And I thought, well, have you ever self-questioned the other way around? What if I really love it?
Yeah.
Right? Because it's a bottle of wine. Yes, we misinvest occasionally, but we misinvest all the time when you work. How many hours do you work too much? Or
thank you. We have no problems wasting money that way.
But you see, or when we throw food out, which is a crime. But it's...
Have you found any... I mean, what you just described is exactly why I love the way the wines of Spain and Portugal as much as I do.
They're unbeatable right now.
Because the value and the price, I mean, you never have to spend. If you spend more than $30 on a bottle of Spanish wine, it was by choice. You certainly did not have to enjoy a great bottle. And I love that. Tell us about a bottle that you've encountered so far that surprised you. Were there any where, like, you didn't go into it, but you were pleasantly surprised at how good it was?
I mean, look, I'm obviously in a very unique and very privileged position that, you know, I taste wine all the time and in all sorts of price ranges. But to answer your question, for instance, I like German Rieslings. In that segment, you get a ton of value, and even the dry ones. You get a ton of value, tons, right? So I think that's something which is completely overlooked. I know people see with Riesling always sweet, but that's not the case. Look, I'm sipping right now the Grüner Veltliner. It's accidentally mine, I give it, admit it. But
no,
in that kind of category, ordering Grüner Veltliner is super safe.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
I've not had a bad bottle.
In that price segment, it's really hard to screw up that one. It's very difficult. For instance, but stepping a little bit out of the Germanistic area. For instance, the Godeos, I had one from Raul Perez. Super tasty.
Oh, his is so good.
Super
when you
tasty.
Had posted the picture of your cellar, like, I spy with my little eye.
Oh, my God.
That is the Altria from Mencia, which I love. And that's a super value wine. At that price point, I mean, you could buy 6 bottles of that and eat. Drink it by itself. Drink it with an array of foods. It's just delicious.
Correct. Or look, I don't forget about the new South America. When you go, just look to Pedro Parra, the Ima Nicanor.
Yes.
It's San So. Everybody is chasing all these crazy wines. But if you buy that wine, you know, that's still below $20 and it's delicious.
So good.
It's delicious.
I want people to do more of that. And I think that, you know, hearing, you know, you're revered at a certain level because of just your experience and who you are. But I always find it to be, it's almost like it's a reminder that, like, you never lose your passion for this, how enthusiastic you are about always trying the bottle that you've never seen before, or you've not heard of this producer or anything like that. So now, this is the part of the show where we ask you, what is it? Like, everyone's shopping for wine now. People are ordering online more than ever. What is the region? You're going to say Grüner Veltliner, but I'm going to ask anyway. What's the region or grape or producer that you feel that if someone is open to exploring a little bit, there are some real gems to be found and some really tasty wines that might not be on their radar? Where would you tell them, what wines would you encourage them to try?
Well, you obviously put already an answer into my mouth. I haven't said nothing. But since you go there, I answer your question where you gave the answer already. And I comment on that, and then I give you my answer.
Okay, fair.
Yes, I couldn't agree more with you. And again, I've seen it myself when I spent the summer in Austria. Austria is freaking crazy good. It's just, and the value you get also out of it, whether it's in white, but also in reds. Really, really interesting wines. And if you go into, if you want to call it that way, in the natural wine scene, even there's some really excellent wines from top producers. Now, that being said, I'd still, and you mentioned this before, I would stay up in Galicia right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the area which, to me, in white, in red, is on absolute fire. And you get a ton of wine for not much money.
Nothing. They're practically giving, you know, there's a part of me that for the producers that I know from that region stuff, I want to be like, oh man, you guys could charge double for this wine and it would still be worth it, but don't, because I very much enjoy the price point.
But keep one thing in mind. What to me becomes really apparent is, and this is the beauty about wine. Look, it brings people together from all different cultures, from all different races, from all different confessions. And I give you a good example. Look how many young winemakers went to Spain, went to France, went to Italy, did internships there. Now they go back home with their acquired knowledge and putting that knowledge that they acquired in their back home country. And the whole world right now is on fire as a result.
Yes. You know, during Le Fête du Champagne, I listened and got to, it was a great interview with Peter Lim and Anselm Salos and his son. And he spoke about the impact that the time he spent at Lopez de Heredia and how much that has influenced the way he approaches winemaking. Now, I almost fainted at that point because I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Like, my favorite champagne on the planet is influenced by one of my favorite Spanish producers. What a full circle moment. But the way that intersectionality is happening and people are taking things from different parts of the world and then going back to their own terroirs and their own traditions and just modifying and inserting these new ways in it. It's such a great time to be a consumer because there's so much great wine out there.
That's why I'm always hesitant, often a little bit, to give you a region because it became a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
I agree, but
it's because you have so much knowledge.
I mean, look what comes out of South Africa right now.
Yeah.
Or look what comes out of Australia right now.
The crazy part about South Africa is so much of the great wines being produced there because their rules and laws are so restrictive, we don't get them here in the States. But what a phenomenal country that is. And there's so many great wines. You know, I've been on an Israeli kick where I've been blown away by some of the wines that I've had from Israel. Oh my gosh. Look, I could talk to you for like 3 hours. I have to give you some of your time back. All right, let's play this game. And then this is always fun. You don't have to think about it very long. You can't think about it very long. Just first answer that comes to your head. Okay, ready? All right, if you have a day that isn't good, it's a bad day, and you get home and you want to open a bottle or pour yourself something, what is your go-to drink? It can be wine or it can be a spirit or a cocktail.
If you have a
really bad day, a beer.
It's a beer.
Really?
Yeah.
A lager?
You know, to be very honest, it depends a little bit on the season. In the winter, I drink Radeberger.
Okay.
In the summer, I like Jever or Kölsch.
Huh. I did not see that answer coming.
When you taste wine all day long, the last thing you want at the end of the night is another wine. I drink wine sometimes, you know, I rarely go out because I have to be functional the next day. But after work, you know, if you work a dinner shift, you know, I'm fired up. I want something to refresh me, to bring me down. And with the bitterness, with the crispness, the beer does it for me. And then if you want, I can have a glass of wine. But I always have my beer first.
It's going to be a beer. Okay, good one. All right. And then we reverse that. And it's been a great day. The stars have aligned. Everything has gone well. And now you're going to come home and relax and bask in the goodness of the day.
After
what are
work?
You drinking then? Yeah.
A beer.
Or if it's your day off.
A day off is different.
You're not going to work today. All right. For this one, then, we'll answer for a day off where everything went well.
Everything went well. Yesterday, to give you the truth, look, yesterday I had a great day. I went on my trainer. I prepared myself for you. And Catherine made a stew, and I brought a Barolo.
Ah, okay.
So, and it was delicious.
Was it old or young?
It was a 2013 Baudana.
Oh, okay. I like the 13s. I feel like they're a sophisticated group of youngins that I very much enjoy.
I bought that in Grey Market, believe it or not. And obviously it's more than $20. But I think I bought it for $45. It was super delicious.
Oh, that's really good. Okay.
Yeah.
Ah, nice. All right. And then this is the controversial question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Now, I know you're open to drinking all things and all grapes and from all regions, but is there a grape or region that just, you've tried several of them and you're just not the biggest fan of a particular grape or wine? Is there anything that just, you can recommend great ones that are tasty, but it's not for you?
I am not a moody person, but I'm a very moody drinker.
Okay.
And I look always for that in seasonality. You know, what are we cooking? Is it cold outside? Is it 100 degree outside? I look at that. And I taste wine all the time. So I try, one thing I really try not to do is putting these things up that I kind of block and limit myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned this by, you know, changing my natural wine opinion that you shouldn't do that because there will always come this one person who will prove you wrong. And I struggled for the longest time, and I still do, and to answer your question, with Grenache Blanc. I struggle with
really?
That grape. That's what I struggle with. But again, listen, okay. This might be a
what
shocker.
What is it missing? What is it missing?
It just, it doesn't grab me.
Okay.
I've tried, but listen, this is not, it's not a criticism. It's just something where...
You're still open to it.
I'm still open to it. And again, if someone tells me, listen, I have the best, have something which might change your mind, I am delighted.
I felt that way about Viognier.
Yeah.
Excluding Condrieu, because those are great, but I don't think I should have to spend that much to find a great expression of the grape. But then I had an Israeli one. And what I always find Viognier to be lacking is acid. And I hate it. It's just too weighty, too flabby, too perfumed. Most expressions of it, I just don't enjoy. But I had this Israeli one from the Judean Hills, and it was delicious. It had a beautiful amount of acidity. It was still quite aromatic and perfumed, but I loved it. Like, I kept going back to it. And the first time I tasted it, there were a bunch of people on the Zoom that know my level of disdain for Viognier. So they were all cracking up about it. But even though I say I don't like that grape, I continue to drink it because there has to be an expression of it that I enjoy.
I mean, yeah. Again, I don't have the liberty of writing everything off, you know. I just don't mm-hmm. because I have clients who like that.
Yeah.
And I have to cater that. So, look, it's good.
I mean, it's a good thing. It's a good thing to keep drinking. But, you know, I like when people tell me what they don't like
and
because you get to understand their palate a little better. When you say you don't like something, like, what is it that you don't like? You know, and then the exercise of trying to correlate that with what you know. Like, all right, is it tannin that they don't like? Is it acid that they don't like? Is it just this greenness that they don't like? That's always a fun analysis to go through.
Ah, so you want to read their palate?
I do. I love understanding that. And I always like to ask people, what are you eating? You know, because I think that's something that needs to, oh my God, we're going to have like an episode 2 with you because we have so much more that we can discuss. I'm like, we need to get Eric on so that we can talk about this too. But that is something that I think also needs to be worked on in the wine world is understanding that the traditional food and wine pairings that a lot of people are trained for in these educational bodies in wine is not actually what people are eating at home, right? And if you can only pair wines with the dishes on the menu at the restaurant, you're failing the consumer, right?
I mean,
they need to know what to drink at home with what they cook.
I mean, listen, we have this ongoing thing with Eric. You know, when I started Le Baradin, he drank only Bordeaux. And I thought, how is that possible? There's actually a YouTube episode, if you go Perfect Pairing and Bordeaux.
I have to watch that.
Now we both are on there. And of course, we highly disagree with each other. And it's quite funny. But but look, I get his point. At home, first of all, the way how we cook at the restaurant, you couldn't execute at home. It's just so time intensive and it's so elaborate. That's one. And secondly, who does a wine pairing at home? And to Eric's point, he said, look, a Bordeaux is very consistent. You might have a salad, you might have a steak, and then you have maybe some cheese or dessert. Obviously, a very French type of menu. But going into that, and I have to give it to him, listen, a Bordeaux is a very good all-rounder in that sense, right? But of course, I mean, this can be any other wine. And we can use... you could use it easily in Mencia with that too and make that logic work.
Very easily.
It's the point is, you know, when you have a wine which kind of communicates with the food, you get kind of a little pairing up, it just tastes so much better.
Yeah. But something as simple as that, as you mentioning a salad, right? So many people do not think that red wine and salad go. I'm like, but you would put strawberries in a salad, right? You'd put cranberries in a salad, right? So then why wouldn't you be able to find a red wine that would also go with a salad if you're putting a bunch of red fruit on top of your salad?
Huh.
Oh, man.
I've never elaborated that one.
Yes.
Really?
It's true. Yeah. Listen, if it's acid, right, you have the bitterness of the greens and then acid, right? But if you have a wine that is moderately acidic, not overly acidic, but if you think of some of these salads, right, if you have a salad and the salad has strawberries, goat cheese, and candied walnuts, right, you have the warm baking spices and nuttiness of a candied walnut. You have bright red fruit, which is sugar and acidity in the strawberries. And then you have the creaminess of goat cheese. Why would that be limited to just white wine?
Shakira, you're going to hate me now.
Okay.
I'm challenging,
we're going to end the show?
I'm challenging you publicly, and I'm going to stream this live. where I question your theory on this. And I am happy when you win.
Okay.
But I have a hard time to believe that.
Okay. I'm going to have to come over and make you a salad and pour you a glass of red wine. I'm going to make you a salad that goes with Raul Perez's, with that Mencia. That's what we're going to have.
I love it. I love it.
And we're going to live. We're going to do a Facebook, Instagram live when you taste the salad and the pairing.
Absolutely. Listen,
but you know what? In that pair, the greens can't be excessively bitter. If it's a very bitter green, it won't work.
And I bring the white wine.
All right. Fair.
Right?
We're doing this. That's it.
Fair.
It's documented. It is on the podcast. We're going to do it. Oh my goodness. We could literally talk for 2 hours. I've already taken more than your hour, but this was such a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This time to chat with us. Please tell everybody where, if they're not already following you, which I'm going to go and say that most of my listeners are, but if they're not already following you on social media, where can they follow you?
At AutoSom and at Sombar.
There you go. Follow us too. Also, you guys know you watch me on Weekly Wine. Every week there's someone asking me what glasses are those. It is always a Zalto glass.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. That you find on AutoSom.com.
There you go. So if you want these glasses that I'm always drinking out of, that is where you're going to go. I want to once again thank you guys for subscribing and listening. I can't believe that here we are in season 2. We're going to have to get Eric on here. We're going to have to talk to him about some of, you know, his philosophies on food and wine. Le Bernardin, it remains one of the best dining experiences that I've ever been fortunate enough to have more than once. And it's wonderful. And it's definitely a bucket list restaurant that you should put on there. But I hope that you guys take so many gems away from this very rich conversation. Aldo, thank you for being here. I so appreciate our friendship.
Oh, thank you.
I'm very happy that I asked you that very awkward question so many moons ago, because it has blossomed into a friendship that I truly appreciate and cherish.
No, same here.
Yay. Well, guys, thank you for listening. And we will see you next week for another episode of A Glass for Every Palate. Cheers. This episode of A Glass for Every Palate was brought to you by Blinders. Are you sick and tired of joining Zooms that really are just people staring at each other? I have an idea. Get your friends a set of Blinders deck and have a great Zoom, blind tasting, drinking wine, and having fun. Blinders is a great game to enjoy and expand your wine palate no matter what level you are at. Go to shop.somtv.com and get your deck of Blinders now.